Well, for those of you who've been asking when I was going to be up here again speaking, this is it. Talk about being in the moment. That's my announcement. So there is a well-known Zen koan. A traveler walks across a field and suddenly comes upon a tiger. The tiger chases her. Reaching the edge of a cliff, she finds a vine. And hanging over the edge, she catches a hold of it and swings herself to escape the tiger. Looking down, she sees another tiger below, waiting to eat her. Just then, two mice appeared, a white one and a black one, and they begin to gnaw away at the vine to which she clung. The vine becomes thinner and thinner. At that moment, she sees a wild strawberry growing on a bush just within reach. With one hand firmly grasping the vine, she reaches out with the other and plucks the ripe strawberry. How sweet it tastes. Here's my take on it. We, of course, are the person on the vine, which is our lifespan. The tigers are our fears, anxieties, and obsessions. The tiger chasing from behind represents the regrets, hurts, the what might have beens of the past. The tiger waiting below, at the end of our ever-thinning rope, is our future. Death, of course, but worse than that, because death is inevitable, are the worries about the how and the when of it and the bad things that may befall us along the way. Both tigers distract us from the present moment, which is represented by the strawberry. And the mice? The black one stands for night and the white one for day. Together, they represent the passage of time, gnawing away at our lifespan. Notice, however, that the person hanging on the vine does not let go of it. She does not give up on life. She reaches out for the strawberry while holding the vine. This is the paradox of non-attachment. She is fully aware of the necessities of daily living, but not so obsessed with them that she can't at the same time be in the moment with the wild strawberry. This is the middle way. Memories are fine, plans are good, anxious obsession over them, not so much. And in case I don't get back to this later, I want you to know that non-attachment, which is necessary for being in the moment, is not the same as resignation or giving up on life or your loved ones or your responsibilities. On the contrary, it means holding on with a loose grip as long as holding on is required, and then letting go when it's time to let go. As soon as we enter the world from our mother's womb, the first moments of consciousness begin and continue until around age 3 to 5. They begin to become a ceaseless stream of musings, anticipations, anxieties, memories, daydreams, silent conversations with yourself, regrets, and worries. It's what the Buddhists call the monkey mind. I love the monkey mind so much I wrote a song about it. If one person remembers it, I'll feel good today. My introduction to the idea of impermanence and non-attachment came early, not through Buddhism, but through the Bible my parents gave me for Christmas when I was 14. I read the whole thing cover to cover. When I got to the book of Ecclesiastes, I was stunned. At the heart of this book, in the wisdom literature of Jewish writings, is the question, what is a life for anyway? Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, or Koheleth. All is vanity. Now, the word hevel has been variously translated as futility, meaninglessness. Did I get enough lesses in there? Meaninglessness, emptiness, vapor and vanity. It connotes the transient, ephemeral nature of life. Sometimes when this guy's writing, you get the sense he means it cynically, like futility and meaninglessness, which can tend toward apathy and despair. Other time, it clearly leans toward impermanence and the fleeting vapor-like quality of life, which tend toward appreciation of the present moment and its pleasures. He opens with something that sounds like a description of the Buddhist word dukkha, or dissatisfaction. All things are wearisome, more than one can express. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, or the ear filled with hearing. The narrator, we are told, is Solomon, a king with unlimited resources to consume everything and every one he wants. Real estate, orchards, concubines, musicians. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them, he says. I kept my heart from no pleasure. But at the end of all this acquisition, Solomon remained dissatisfied. Then I considered all my hands had done, and behold, all was vanity, emptiness, and a striving after wind. There was nothing to be gained under the sun. Imagine the joy of reading this when you're 14 years old. But as you move forward through the monologue, the author seems to offer a path beyond meaninglessness and apathy. Enjoy life with the woman whom you love all the days of your fleeting life. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might, for there is no work or thought or knowledge or wisdom in the grave to which you are going. Seize the moment, eat your bread with enjoyment, and drink your wine with a merry heart. In summary, enjoy some food and drink, but above all, find somebody to love. So it's not endless consumption, but that human connection. Love. Does anybody know the writer Brian Doyle? He's got a book called One Long River of Song. And I have to thank Debbie because she pointed me to this essay in there called Leap. He tells the story of a couple who leaped from the South Tower hand in hand on 9/11. Many people jumped, maybe hundreds. A kindergarten boy who saw people falling in flames told his teacher that the birds were on fire. She ran with him on her shoulders out of the ashes. Steve Tomas counted 14 people jumping, and then he stopped counting. He saw the couple join hands, as did other witnesses. No one knows who they were, husband and wife, lovers, dear friends, colleagues, strangers thrown together at the window there at the tip of hell. Doyle says, I keep coming back to his hand and her hand nestled in each other with such extraordinary, ordinary, succinct, ancient, naked, stunning, perfect, simple, ferocious love. Their hands reaching and joining are the most powerful prayer I can imagine, the most eloquent, the most graceful. It is everything that we are capable of against horror and loss and death. For everything there is a season, says Qoheleth, and a time for every matter under the heaven. Time to be born, time to die, time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to seek and a time to lose. I went to a tiny little high school, and it was so small I could be, if not a big fish, at least a medium-sized fish in a small pond. I played football, basketball, and I ran track. Even the smallest losses can carry great torment of our consciousness. It was the last football game of my high school career, a CIF playoff game in the smallest division in the CIF. We were the underdog. The other team was better. We knew it. They knew it. Everybody knew it. But we prepared and practiced really hard all week to prove everybody wrong. The game started, and we were winning. We had 15 first downs to their 3. I was so elated. But on the strength of 2 big plays, including a length of field return of an interception that I had thrown, they were within 1 touchdown. And in the final seconds, the other team scored and won the game. The loss was heart-crushing. We should have won. It was at our fingertips. From an objective standpoint, in the big picture, 1 high school football game doesn't amount to much. But it's not the size of the loss that matters. It's the lingering power it has to steal your present moments. For years, decades even, I was haunted by that loss. I have reimagined, because you can't go back and relive it. I've reimagined key plays in that game over and over again, what I should have done instead of throwing that interception. Sometimes late at night, instead of falling asleep, I would once again begin redesigning our final play on offense, trying to outrun the defense and making the first down to keep possession. But would I have been fast enough? Could I outrun the Tiger? Not once did any of these reimaginings change the outcome of the game. But don't we all have that tape in our heads that we keep rewinding? What we should have done, how it would be different if we had a do-over? That difficult conversation where you had just the right answer, but a day late? Words you said to your mother you wish you hadn't. The things she said to you, the love that got away, the circle that excluded you, the job you wanted but didn't get. For me, every time I replay one of these scenes, it takes me away from the only thing that is real, this present moment. My father was raised in a family with 11 siblings, poor and itinerant during the Great Depression in Canada and the U.S. By the time he moved out at age 16, he had attended 13 different schools. When I asked him why he moved out at such a young age, he said, "I just figured there would be more food for the rest of them." I never heard a complaint from Dad about his father's life and work choices, but neither did I hear any warm stories. Not one. And I know Dad was determined to make sure his family did not suffer on account of his work choices. Dad became a minister and eventually a marriage and family therapist, but in the early days, to support his young family, he worked various jobs, including construction. I heard lots of stories. Once a carpenter came onto a job site and asked the contractor boss for a job. "Can you fix your own mistakes?" the contractor asked. The carpenter said, "I don't make mistakes." "Then I can't use you." Mistakes will be made. The only question is what to do next. Dad always built the homes we lived in wherever we moved. It's a habit that I picked up. He made some good decisions along the way and got lucky. When he had enough extra money, he helped all 4 of his surviving sons with a down payment to buy their own home. That's what got me started. In my mid-20s, spiritually and occupationally adrift, and on extended leave from grad school, I got a call from Dad. He was going to build another house in Lynn Ranch. Would I like to go work with the contractor he had hired to do the foundation and framing? That way I could learn how to do it and maybe build my own someday. It seemed to me a lot better than painting houses, so I said yes. About a year later, Dad found a little lot in Thousand Oaks. Would I like to sell my house and build one from the ground up? He would help me build it. Again, I say yes. But then, just before breaking ground, Dad took an assignment overseas, a teaching assignment, in the Philippines. So, no more help from Dad. But I figured it out. I actually learned twice as much on that project as the average carpenter, because I did everything twice. I fixed my own damn mistakes. Mom and Dad came back to the States. He was semi-retired and got another lot, this one in Newbury Park. He told me, right at the edge of Dos Vientos, before there was anything to do with Dos Vientos besides horses, he told me how great it was going to be out there building with a clear view of Mount Boney. There was another vacant lot across the cul-de-sac. How would I like to sell the house we had been in for 4 years and build one there? Okay, I said. I would help him build his, and he would help me build mine. I did help him build his. It was mostly done, and across the street, I was framing mine. Now, there are 5 lots on the cul-de-sac, all raised about 15 to 20 feet from the street level. I was on one side, and he was across the street. One day, I saw Dad pouring a little 10-foot diameter patio at the edge of the yard while I was across the street sawing and pounding away at the lumber. Then I looked again, and he was gone. Concrete was wet and soon to be setting up. I figured he went inside for a break, but he did not come back out. I went over to the house and learned he wasn't feeling well and had lied down. So I went back out and finished the concrete slab. For several months, Dad had been complaining of abdominal pain, feeling like he had a flu that just wouldn't go away. But the doctors couldn't figure it out. I have a folk singer friend, Randall Lamb, who turned 80 this year. He tells funny stories. He said, "If you haven't had cancer yet, be patient." Dad's doctors did more tests and then a biopsy. We were all waiting at the hospital. The doctor gave Mom the news first. We all went into his recovery room. We looked at him. He looked at us. He spoke first. "From the looks on your faces, it's not good news." It was not. It was pancreatic cancer that had metastasized everywhere. I blurted out, "I can't imagine life without you, Dad." And he said, "You know, I think the world of you, Merlin." I suppose I did know. But it was really nice to hear it in front of the whole family in the room and to know that the love between us was greater than any theological differences, greater than anything. And that was it. That was our goodbye. He would live 3 more months with ups and downs and then more downs and more pain. And I would hear a few more stories. But that was our moment at the hospital. And I never forgot the lesson to share the love while you can. Grab that strawberry, taste every last drop. So again, Dad was unable to help me build my house. I did not blame him or the Great Spirit. I might as well have blamed gravity or the ocean tides and what gifts he had given me. Encouragement, direction, confidence, I could try anything. A sense that everything would be all right, come what may. Mom lived another 15 years after Dad. She was the sole anchor of our family. She gave me music and the example of unconditional love. She was the nurturer. While Dad was deeply compassionate, he usually kept his affection well shielded. Mom spread it out like sunshine on a summer day. Have you heard the line about how there are two kinds of people? Those who have had cancer and those who will? Mom's turn came 15 years after Dad's. She died in our home, surrounded by family. When it was over, Debbie flung open the French doors of the room where she was staying, as if to expel the cancer demon and death itself. "Go free, Mom, fly free." And there on the patio, Debbie looked down and found a hawk's feather. We took that as a good omen. Now flash forward 7.5 years to when Debbie and I have become grandparents. There are two infants from two of our sons, and I have this dream. In my dream, I am back on the cul-de-sac where we and my parents used to live, where we built those houses. I am down at the street level by the curb. There's a mailbox post. And I look down and see two dolls leaned up against the post. And I am alarmed. And immediately, I gather up the dolls in my arms, thinking, these need protection. I walked up the driveway to the house where we used to live, where in my dream, I still live. I walk into the open garage where I used to have my cabinet shop. And I open the door from the garage to the house, looking for my mom. Where's Mom? She'll know what to do with these little ones. I see her in her house coat that she often wore in the mornings. But she pays no attention to me. She's busy. She's got things to do. And I recognize, oh, these are for me. And I take the dolls and I put them in the cabinet in my shop where I made my living. And I awake. It's my turn to do what I can, and I only play a little small part. Over the years, I've often reflected on how Dad didn't hoard the money he managed to get, but spread it out when he could. He had no idea he would die at 67, or how small was the window to do good in the world. This awareness, do it while you can, has shaped the way I relate to my own children, to everyone really, in some small way. Solomon Kohelet was right, you know, life is as ephemeral as morning mist. Only the love you share in this moment matters. One day I will lose all my faculties, the use of my hands that have built and loved and picked 1,000 chords. All my colors will run dry. But today, wow. What a luscious strawberry. My old guitar playing buddy who taught me much of my early guitar knowledge, Mike, who is my age, same month of October, told me recently he no longer has the strength to play a bar chord. A bar chord is what you do. You take your thumb and your index finger like a vise, and you grip the neck of the guitar, and you got these other fingers to pick out some notes. And it's a real milestone for a beginning guitar player. But Mike can't do it anymore. He no longer has the strength. So naturally, I wonder, what am I going to do when I can't play a bar chord anymore? And that worries me. That and a great many other things. But when my consciousness is properly tuned, I take that thought, I breathe it in, then I let it out, so I can return to whatever is actually happening here and now. So do not worry about tomorrow, Jesus said, for tomorrow will worry about itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. Tomorrow's goodbyes can wait. Today is for today. Today is for love. In the words of the old African-American spiritual we are going to sing momentarily, when I come to the end of my road and I lay down my heavy load, let the life I've lived, let the love I've shared speak for me.